Ave listeners, if you want to see myself and Rhiannon record a live episode of Emperors of Rome on stage, then now is your chance. On the 22nd of November, in Melbourne, Australia, at the Wheeler Centre, we'll be discussing Cleopatra, her life, her rule, and her relationship with both Caesar and Mark Antony. You can get tickets on the Wheeler Centre website. Hope to see you there. Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a podcast about the rulers of the ancient Roman Empire. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me as always is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, a lecturer in ancient Mediterranean studies at La Trobe University. This is episode LVIII, Tacitus. If you've listened to the vast majority of the early episodes of Emperors of Rome, you'll know that Tacitus is a renowned Roman historian. He was one of our most reliable sources for information on the early emperors. So now we discuss his life and work directly. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
Tacitus is one of the most important Roman historians that we have, due to his extensive writings on the Julio-Claudian and the Flavian periods. Tacitus was also a senator and he became a consul. And he actually worked his way up into the senatorial rank because he was born in the equestrian rank. So he's somebody who's clearly very important in Roman politics, but also he doesn't just have a sideline in history. He's known even while he's alive as a really significant and great writer. So people want to talk to Tacitus. He's sort of a literary star of his times.
We've got a fair bit that Tacitus has written, and we've discussed this to some extent in earlier podcasts, and we'll discuss it a bit later. But as far as facts about his life, we know surprisingly little, don't we?
Yes, and that's the case for lots of authors. Really, we tend to know only what they tell us, and sometimes people infer a bit too much from that. And sometimes other people will mention them, contemporaries or people just slightly later. So it's actually quite surprising that now Tacitus is alive in the second half of the first century CE into the second century. But some of our most important writers from that period, we tend to know nothing about them outside of their writings. Mm. We know a tiny bit about Tacitus, but for example, we don't have exact dates for when he was alive. Unfortunately, we don't have a death notice. No, we don't have a convenient letter saying, oh, it's a terrible shame, Tacitus, the great historian, has just died. We're lucky in that one of the texts he wrote was a biography of his father-in-law. So he sort of has to talk a bit about his family there. But, you know, it's not about him. It's about his father-in-law. So there's a little bit of indirect information. And that's very unfortunate. It would be good to know more about him and to be able to place him in context.
Okay, so infer away. Let's start with the reliable tome of Wikipedia giving us exact dates of when he was born. 56 CE to 120 CE. And my disclaimer is every book that I've got written by Tacitus has a different date in the front. Died during the time of Trajan, died during the time of Hadrian, died in this year, born in this year. So the goalposts seem to have moved throughout the years, which is fair enough. And that's also a disclaimer that we should maybe apply to Wikipedia, as in...
Yeah, look, 56 to 120 are not terrible guesses. Mm. If you had to make up dates, then they would be certainly defensible. Tacitus was alive at that time. He was certainly writing in the early second century CE. One of the ways that we might try to gauge his age is that we know that he was consul in 97. And technically, you're not meant to be consul until the age of 42. However, people are playing fast and loose with that rule at this point. Yeah. So whether you can actually use it to age him, which I think might be what whoever wrote the Wikipedia entry might be doing, because that would fit, because the Romans count inclusively. You can work with that to a certain extent, but you have to have all of those footnotes and disclaimers on it. Most authors, or most scholars rather, that I've seen tend to say he's probably born early in the reign of Nero, which 56 would be, because Nero becomes emperor in 54. And that would certainly work very well with him coming to prominence under the Flavians, who are in charge from 69. So, you know, sometime during the reign of Vespasian or Titus, he's becoming an adult.
With a massive disclaimer at the top then, what can we know and infer about Tacitus and his career. We've even got a question mark over his full proper name, don't we?
We do. We know he's Cornelius Tacitus, yeah. But of course Roman male citizens have three names, and we have different versions of this, Publius or Gaius Cornelius Tacitus. Again, that's true for other authors too. Sometimes we don't know the full name because people just refer to them by either their second or third name. His surname, by the way, Tacitus, means the quiet person. It's a nice name. A lot of people think that he comes from the provinces, and I think there's no problem with that. They think probably from Provence, modern Provence, because he married into a family from that area. So when he writes that biography of his father-in-law, Agricola, he tells us Agricola comes from Massilia, from southern France as it is now. And it's not unlikely that he comes from that area too. What that means is he might be part of this influx of people from the provinces into the center of power, which, as we saw quite a long time ago when we looked at Claudius, remember Claudius is before Tacitus is born, but that it was quite controversial having Gallic senators. Mm. So that's becoming more normalized now. So not only does Tacitus' family rise through the ranks and quite possibly have come from the provinces in the first place, go from equestrian to senatorial, but also he gets to be consul. So he's kind of, he's an outsider coming in, but by this period in the late first century, that's probably more normal than it had been 50 years before that.
Consul during the reign of Nerva, so clearly somebody who flourished well and survived the reign of Domitian.
Yes, and this is quite interesting about Tacitus because he has only negative things to say about Domitian, and I'm sure we talked about that a little bit when we discussed Domitian. He really takes him apart, particularly in that biography of his father-in-law where he implies that Agricola, his father-in-law, really suffered under Domitian because Domitian was jealous of his success, and he basically implies that Domitian finished him off. But we might infer, lots of people do, that there's a slight embarrassment. You don't get to be consul out of nowhere. Mm. You know, he hasn't been banished or exiled. He hasn't been killed by Domitian, and there have been purges. He's got what perhaps survivor guilt. He does talk at times in his works about the people who sacrifice themselves, the people who stand up for what they believe and won't just kowtow to someone like Domitian or to Nero, to another man regarded as a tyrant. And he sort of has this very ambivalent attitude towards them because, yes, they've stood up for what they believe, but in a way he says it's the easy path. It's the easy path to just say, no, I'm not going to do that. Yes, I'll kill myself, which was probably the outcome for many of these men. In fact, he says the hard thing is to do what his father-in-law did. He's using his father-in-law as the example, but clearly I think talking about himself as well, is to negotiate your way through living under a tyrant. The hard thing is to survive. And the hard thing is to keep quiet for that long, ironically, because his name is the Quiet Man. But he does explicitly say that in the Agricola, that it's difficult not to talk, but you have to do it. You have to wait for your moment, as it were. So I think that's probably a response to the times. He certainly sets himself out as anti-Domitianic, but he probably has to do that because people might accuse him of actually doing okay under the Flavians.
He remains a senator for quite a while, but it's what he does later in his life, which is a historian and a writer, that we know him best for.
Exactly.
Let's talk about his writings now. What do we have that he has written?
We have five works by him. We have that biography of his father-in-law, Agricola. We have a sort of ethnography of the Germanic people called the Germania. We have a work called the Dialogus, which is a discussion of rhetoric and the point of oratory at this point in time. They're three short works. For example, in the Oxford Classical Text, they are banded together and they're called Opera Minora, minor works.
Yeah.
And then we have the two major works, certainly they're longer, which are the Annals and the Histories. Mm. The Histories was written before the Annals, but the Histories covers or would have covered the Civil War and the Flavian period, whereas the Annals covers the Julio-Claudians. So if we had all of Tacitus, he would cover from the death of Augustus, which is what the Annals was originally called in antiquity, from 14 CE to 96 CE.
We'll take the Agricola and the Germania first, shall we? Because that seems to be what he wrote first. He's written them in about...
They're usually dated to 98.
Right. And he was still probably a
politician then. He came out of being consul in 97, so...
Yeah, he's probably still engaged with politics to a degree, but this seems to be his sort of almost his way into retirement.
Yeah.
To write these two short works. We can date them as certainly post-Domitian, because he talks about Domitian as being a bad guy, which he wouldn't dare do under Domitian. And we know he's dead by that point. And he talks in the Germania as well about failures against the Germans, and he's clearly referring to Domitian there. So they seem to be early, you know, soon after the death of Domitian, and it would make sense for them to be in 98 because he's no longer consul. The Dialogus is often dated around the same period. That one is interesting because it sort of talks about, is it worth learning oratory now that you can't kind of get into power through your oratorical skills because we're not having elections anymore. And even though that's not spelled out, it sort of is, what's the point of this? It's more for display. It's more for maybe for court cases. Mm. And it's a really important discussion of oratory in general in the ancient world. It's done as a dialogue, obviously. And one of the speakers in particular seems to feel that it's a bit pointless at this point in history to be learning rhetoric. The other two are, I guess, more read. The Agricola is particularly read because even though it's supposedly a biography of Agricola, it's mostly about his time in Britain. He was governor of Britain in the 70s and 80s, and it's about his spread of power, of Roman power, to the north of Britain.
Mm.
So the Agricola was particularly read in British schools and universities because it told us a lot about Roman control in Britain, far more than we'd known from other texts, I guess. I mean, Julius Caesar talks about going to Britain and battles in Britain, but of course he doesn't invade. So that's a really important text for learning about Britain, but also for learning about the feeling of malaise that Tacitus sees hanging around in the Domitianic period. So it tells us a lot about Tacitus and his attitude towards the emperorship.
Yeah, yeah. Why do you think he wrote the Agricola?
Well, he was clearly very much in awe of his father-in-law. He had married Agricola's daughter, Julia Agricola, in the 70s. And he seems to have had a closeness and saw him as the ideal Roman.
Mm.
And he talks about Agricola's family as well. So his mother, Agricola's mother, as being perfect and a perfect example of kind of the hardiness of the Gauls combined with the sophistication of the Romans. And by implication, he sort of sees the same strengths in Agricola's daughter. So
yeah.
He's married well in his view. He's married into a family who are both important but represent significant Roman virtues. And the Germania is, I love the Germania, but it's a bit of a weird piece in that we don't have anything else like it. We don't have any other ethnography on its own. Often we get it as part of a history, but we have very little where it's just, I'm going to tell you about this group of people. He tells us lots of interesting things that I guess at one time were taken as, you know, people would go looking for proof of what Tacitus had said about the Germans. Now it's been studied in a much more sophisticated way, and it's pretty clear that a lot of it is actually about the Romans. And there's this idea that the Germans might be seen as almost, this is a modern term, but as noble savages against which the Romans might judge their own decline.
Mm.
So it's a very interesting text, but you wouldn't necessarily go looking for facts about the Germans there. Although it was popular with the Nazis because it describes the Germans as very hardy.
Yeah, yeah. There was doubt as to whether Tacitus ever went to Germania at all, isn't there?
Well, given that we know so little about his life, we certainly don't know that. It's not out of the question, given Roman interest in that area, but it's quite likely that he could have gathered these facts from people who had travelled there or texts that he read, and that he didn't necessarily have first-hand experience of them.
His other two works, let's talk about those. So the Histories was written before the Annals, and these are seen as the central texts of Tacitus.
Yes, I would say the Annals is more read. That's because we've got more of it left. And it's about the Julio-Claudians, who I suppose are slightly more studied than the Flavians. So he's writing the Histories early in Trajan's reign, but it's about the rise to power of the Flavians. So it's about the civil war of 69 and the first half of 70 CE, so when Vespasian is ensconced as emperor. So we get the retelling of the war in Jerusalem, which Titus is still engaged in. We get the civil war and the sort of embarrassing bit where Domitian gets caught up in the Capitoline Temple of Jupiter and has to escape dressed as a woman. But we don't get any further into Vespasian's reign, and we're missing all of Titus and all of Domitian.
Mm.
So it would have gone up to 96. We're missing 26 years of it. And there are various theories about how long it would have been. Might have been 30 books long, might have been shorter than that. We don't have anything after about a section of book five. So we've lost an awful lot there, which is a terrible shame.
Yes, yes. And for the annals, it's pretty much all of the Julio-Claudians with gaps missing as well.
Yes, we're missing all of Caligula, for instance.
Mm.
And then it peters out in the last 2 years of Nero's life as well. So we don't have the very end of Nero, which would have been great, I think.
Between these two texts, then, we've got about half of it, don't we?
Yeah, exactly. We've got more of the annals, which I suppose many people regard as the greater work. He wrote it later.
Mm.
Interestingly, he wrote it later, and you can infer what you want from this, after saying in the histories that he was going to write about the Flavians now, and he was giving over his old age to writing about his own times. In other words, Nerva Trajan, possibly Hadrian. But he never did write about them.
What can we say about Tacitus's writing style?
Well, it's often regarded as very sententious, in that he will make very clever points about the human condition or how very despotic the period has become. So, for example, perhaps one of his most famous statements is that things had become so tortured and dramatic during the Neronian period. Everybody knew they had to act a part. So perhaps it's more tense. You know, nobody could say what they actually meant. So that Octavia, who is Nero's first wife, who's very, very young, she knows not to appear shocked when her own brother Britannicus kind of falls ill at the table because he's being poisoned. And remember, Nero claims it's an epileptic fit.
Mm.
Tacitus says she'd already learned to train her emotions. She knew that to survive, which unfortunately she didn't, it didn't save her in the end, that she had to just appear blank. So he'll say things like that, everybody had to put on a face. He will write in a very dramatic way in some ways, I think we would regard as quite dramatic, but it's very engaging. He'll also write in a way that does something which is called giving the invidious alternative. For example, quite often he'll say, we don't know, he might not say it outright, but we don't know exactly what the cause of this was. But he'll give you a suggestion, and then he'll give you another suggestion. And the other suggestion is often the invidious alternative.
Mm.
And we can presume it's the one Tacitus wants us to believe. But because he doesn't have proof, or maybe it's dangerous to say it, he doesn't come out and say it. So, for example, early in book one of the Annals, when Tacitus is explaining the succession, so Augustus is succeeded by Tiberius, and he's talking about the various people that Augustus had set up for succession, all of whom, as we know, died before Augustus. Tacitus says, when Agrippa died, that is Agrippa Postumus, who's Augustus's third grandson, and Lucius Caesar, who's Augustus's grandson adopted by him, and Gaius, another grandson, while returning from Armenia, still suffering from a wound, when they were prematurely cut off by destiny or by their stepmother Livia's treachery.
So either destiny
So the invidious alternative is Livia killed them off.
Yeah.
While he hasn't spelled it out, he suggested it to us. Of course it lingers in our mind, and we're left with the impression that we then get in Robert Graves's I, Claudius, that Livia was a scheming stepmother who just got rid of everyone who stood in the way of her son.
Yeah.
And of course it's borne out by history because Tiberius does become emperor next.
But it could have been destiny. He hedges his bets. He's the master of the quotation fingers there. Livia could have been responsible for overcrowding in the mausoleum of Augustus, or, you know, it could have been destiny.
Yeah, they could have all just died natural deaths.
Yes.
And in a way, he's also playing with what he has claimed he will do, which is to treat everybody fairly. So he claims he's going to write without partiality or anger. He does this very famously early on in the Annals. I think most modern scholars of Tacitus sort of have a little giggle at that point, because it's very clear that Tacitus is on the side of the Senate and emperors who have respect for the Senate.
Mm.
By the way, Tacitus, he doesn't discuss Augustus in much detail because the Annals starts with the death of Augustus. But he gives us one paragraph précis of all of Rome's history to that point. He says it was originally ruled by kings, then we had the Republic, and then it was usurped by tyranny, he basically says. So he lays out his cards fairly early on that he regards the Principate as something that has taken power away from the people and particularly from the Senate. And really the best you can hope for is an emperor who will treat the Senate with respect, which is, I suppose, what you could read into it is what he implies is happening under Trajan, or you could read it completely the other way because he never discusses Trajan outright.
So if he's trying to be impartial and trying to be accurate then...
Or at least appear that way.
Appear that way. Then what do we know about his methodology, his historical sources that he's dealing with? As a senator, he would have had access to records to some extent, but he also, you know, went outside that to do his research, didn't he?
Yes, and unfortunately, as is the tradition with ancient historians, he doesn't always tell us what his sources are, which doesn't make him a bad historian in ancient terms. He would have had access to all of those records, perhaps not quite as directly as somebody like Suetonius, who worked within the imperial administration. But he could have got what he wanted. And remember, he's covering eras. I mean, he's alive certainly for a lot of the histories and some of the annals. He would have remembered Nero, and there would have been people alive who would have remembered further back or would have had, you know, spoken to relatives who could have remembered further back. So it's not just records. He's also able to talk to people who had direct experience of suffering under a particular emperor. There's a great book on Tacitus by a historian called Ron Mallor that what the ancients expected from their historians was strong political understanding and good style. Stylistic intelligence, if you like, to write really well. Mm-hmm. And Tacitus certainly has both of those. And that's why he's a star in his own time.
One bit of evidence that we've got as to his research methodology is letters between him and Pliny the Younger. Can you tell me about that from Tacitus's point of view? What was he doing here?
Well, we don't have the letter from Tacitus, unfortunately. We have Pliny's replies to him. And we're not 100% sure that Pliny isn't writing in the hope of being included as one of Tacitus's sources, but they're both important officials in the late first century, early second century. They clearly knew each other, and it's quite likely that Tacitus would have written to Pliny the Younger to get information from him about what happened at Vesuvius, because when he was writing the histories in the early second century, he needed accounts of what happened under the Emperor Titus. And one of the major events was the destruction of Pompeii and Herculaneum. And Pliny the Younger had been there, and Pliny the Elder, his uncle, had been killed there. So that's why we get that account of Vesuvius erupting and the destruction of the city. And, you know, we've actually got an account of what it looked like and also of the death of Pliny the Elder. So it may well be that it's Tacitus's research methodology that gives us that really significant account. I mean, it's irreplaceable, really, as an eyewitness account of what happened there. And we just don't know whether Tacitus used it because that part of the histories is missing.
Yeah.
If we had both of those to put together, we would know so much more about his research methodology. You know, did he make it more melodramatic, or did he actually tone it down because he had other sources that wrote it slightly differently? So, you know, we should all be out there digging away and looking for the rest of the histories because that would tell us so much.
Another thing that Pliny does give us is a bit of buttering up of Tacitus, which I suppose gives us good insight into the regard.
Yeah, if you read that letter carefully, it almost seems like Pliny's a bit of a groupie. Like he desperately wants to be included in this man's writing. And remember, Pliny had been consul recently too, but both very wealthy, influential men. So, for example, Pliny writes to Tacitus. Do you want me to read it in Latin?
Up to you.
Okay. He writes, Auguro nec me fallit augurium, historias tuas immortales futuras. Which means I predict, and my predictions do not fail me, that your histories will be immortal.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, a lecturer in ancient Mediterranean studies at La Trobe University, and you've been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it on iTunes. Please tell your friends about it and leave a review there. You can like the Emperors of Rome podcast on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Rhiannon on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, and I'm at Nightlight Guy. That's it today for Emperors of Rome. So until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.